And you're listening to WMNF Tampa, Sarasota Clearwater, Community Conscious Radio. Hi, I'm Mary Glennie.
And I'm Arlene Engelhart, and you are listening to From a Woman's Point of View. We're so glad to have you with us, and we hope you'll stay with us for the full hour, and just keep your dial tuned to WMNF. We are so fortunate to have this community radio station in our area, and I've heard that from people all over the country who are aware of this station. Well, what a week it has really been and going to be, I'm afraid, for the week coming up. You've been talking, Mary, quite a bit about the opening day of the Senate and the rules that they'll be setting. So what about that concerns you?
This is such an extraordinary time. It's exciting, but yes, I have spent quite a bit of time this week trying desperately to get a yes, because I am hoping. I know everything's changing by the minute, by the hour, by the day, and we are just counting down the time until we have the inauguration. But I am very concerned because, to me, it's not only important that we really get some changes and get them fast, but also I'm very concerned about the undue power of Mitch McConnell. I am very, very worried about his parliamentary powers and how he has prevented not even issues being allowed to be in committee to be discussed that are really essential to all aspects of our life. And so as I understand it, but I don't have the legal constitutional lawyer experience to discuss this well, but on the first day the Senate meets, that they can change their rules, because the Senate is a constant changing body, and so they have the right to change their rules. And to me, the filibuster, just like President Obama said at John Lewis's eulogy, has stood in the way of civil rights, of LGBT rights, of just really so many aspects of our country. And so I really feel very strongly that Mitch McConnell's wings have to be clipped. I'm sure many other outlets, media outlets here, Rob and others, were trying to find out. But anyway, I'm still very excited about this show because we have such outstanding members here in our community doing just extraordinary work, and I'm really excited. Our first guest is going to be Barbara Rode. She's with the Red Tent Initiative, and right now I think we all need to see if we can spend some time in the Red Tent, and she will explain what that's about. And then we are bringing back Pam Campos-Palma, and she's going to be talking about really some of the terrible things that have been happening, not only to women, but to service members, and what the heck is happening not only at Fort Hood but other areas. And so very, very interesting times, exciting, but right now I could do with just a wee bit less excitement. But I am going to put this music on by Ani DeFranco. Arlene, did you want to say something?
Well, I was just going to say, and I think we're all keeping our eyes on what's going to or what may happen this weekend. Oh. And then on into the coming week, up through the inauguration, and maybe even afterwards.
Every day, every moment. Okay, Ani DeFranco, and then we will come back with Barbara Rode.
Good.
And I'm potting this down by Ani DeFranco. A good question to ask. Which side are you on? Because I am so excited. The person I've wanted to be talking to for a long time here on this show, Barbara Rode, and she is the founder of the Red Tent Initiative, and just an extraordinary organization that works with incarcerated women in Pinellas County Jail. And Barbara Rode, I find your life really pretty amazing, but also the work you're doing, it's just extraordinary. So welcome so much to the show.
Oh, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, you know, that as you're so aware that, you know, we all live in a context of our nuclear family, our community, and our extended community. Tell me, and also then with the added terrible shadow of COVID, how are you feeling this morning? What's happening right now in our area, but also in this country?
Well, I'm optimistic because we're on the cusp of a wonderful change politically, I feel. And I'm also hopeful about COVID and the vaccination. And I'm very hopeful that we can get back inside the jail. The jail closed to us, you know, last year and somewhere around March or April. It closed to all programs because of COVID. And I'm actually meeting with personnel at the jail in 2 weeks to talk about the possibility of coming back in as soon as possible.
And you not only work with women in jail, but that you continue that work afterwards. And so this just adds to the burdens, but are you finding then, particularly the women you have worked with and the women in the community, and not just women, but organizations in the community, that they are somehow trying to do anything to help these women? Or is, I guess it's just the way things are.
Well, it's a funny thing, and we're getting a lot of calls from different women. I got a call last week, this one woman who went through our program in 2019, now because of COVID and the loss of a job and some health issues, she was homeless. So we were able to connect her with Pinellas Hope, a wonderful residential facility in Largo that the Catholic Diocese opened. So we're always welcoming the women to call us. We have resources. We can point them in different directions or link them up with the help that they need. But so many people need help right now.
Now, and Barbara Rode, I've been reading about you, and congratulations to you being the L'Oreal winner of Women of the Year award. And I'm sorry we weren't able to have you on the show because you were in a big kind of a contest that if you could get so many people calling or whatever, you could even get extended money. There's been kind of, I always find the universe kind of opens paths if you're open to it. And I was so fascinated. You obviously were very influenced, you know, by reading some books, et cetera. But when this home, you found all of a sudden this home near you where you lived was up for sale. And somebody told you to go in and look at this home. And it was almost as if somebody or the people who lived there just got up and left, just bang, that you still found the comb and the hair. I don't know if you still had the coffee on the thing. And then you realize that the woman on the steps, sitting on the steps, was this woman's daughter.
And
she had committed suicide.
Right.
And you found on her dresser the book that has probably influenced you as much as anything, The
True.
Red Tent by Anita Diamond. Is that what happened?
Yes, exactly. It was an estate sale just a few blocks from my house. And I was going to leave once I heard that the woman who owned the house had committed suicide, and that was her daughter collecting the money at the front door. And it was as if, Mary, something pulled me up these three little steps in her house to her bedroom. Everything was open, and everything was for sale. And I went up there, and I thought, well, I'll just send her some good thoughts and prayers. And there on her nightstand was the Red Tent. And I had already read it. I picked it up. It was like something hit me square in the forehead and said, get started now. And I came home with the book. And I said to my husband, it's time. I've got to go down to the jail and start this class. I just have to. And he was very supportive, and that's what I did in 2012.
And tell me, for those who are not familiar with the book, The Red Tent, tell us about The Red Tent.
It's fiction, and it's placed during biblical times. Anita Diamant is actually a supporter of Red Tent. She keeps in touch with us and emails every once in a while to check to see how things are going. It's a book that really affected me in that it depicted how, at least this was Anita's take, how in biblical times they would put up a red tent in the middle of the village, the community, for women to go and to rest and heal when they were traumatized, going through hormonal changes, having a baby, any grieving. And everybody in the community would support this because they knew if a woman has the opportunity to go and heal, everybody benefits. So it just said so much to me that in our crazy society right now, we need more red tents. And especially this poor woman who took her life in my neighborhood, here she was reading the book. If we'd had a red tent, maybe she would have known she had other choices and options.
Yeah, and I'm fascinated that because I know a lot of indigenous communities have, I don't think it's a red tent or a red teepee, so to speak, but that they had a special area where women would go in those kind of situations. And so, and what particularly, there were lots of other areas, but what particularly attracted you to women in prison?
Well, I have a history of working with people in the criminal justice system. I worked for Goodwill Corrections for 5 years, about 15 years ago, and it really affected me watching the women in the work release program. They had a huge increase of women in work release. In fact, Mary, the number of women behind bars has gone up 750% in the last decade.
750%?
Percent.
And why is that?
Department of Justice, yes.
And do you have any idea why? I mean, what's the increase, say, to, I mean, I don't expect you to be a statistician, but how does that compare, say, to men?
Well, I think it's partially because of mandatory sentencing. It's also because of those pills that became so, you know, flooded our communities, the pain pills.
Oh, right. Fentanyl, the opiates, right,
yes,
et cetera.
And many women were, you know, prescribed by a doctor, a well-meaning doctor, because of a neck injury or a car accident, and then got hooked, and it started that downward spiral. But what we understand about women who are behind bars is most of them are there because of trauma, because of post-traumatic stress disorder. Women respond differently to trauma than men, and oftentimes will self-medicate, and that can lead to incarceration. And most of these women are mothers. So we are not just affecting the woman and separating her from her family and support system, but we're causing separation anxiety and trauma in the children.
Yeah, I've talked to some groups that work with actually adolescents, and so many of the adolescents are suffering sexual trauma. Tragically, many times it's right inside their family, either a stepfather or a boyfriend or whatever. And I think the degree of really aggression and violence to young people and to women is just... honestly, I think if it were happening to men, I think a lot of this would be already have been addressed and dealt with. But because it happens to women, it's kind of somehow seen as a personal issue and not for the community to be involved. And the more light we put on this is absolutely essential. And so
it's essential.
Yeah.
It is essential. And Red Tent is a trauma-informed program. So we bring trauma-informed curriculum into the women at the jail and help them understand this is what led to that downward spiral. This is what led to this self-medicating. And you have other options. And we help them see those other options. We give them tools while they're in class. And I'm hoping that will start again soon. We give them tools to handle the emotional dysregulation that they experience because of the trauma.
And And you know, I'm really impressed because on your website, and I really suggest that the listeners go to your website and get involved. You know, this is a community project. That so many of them, I am a firm believer on, you know, whether it's physical exercise or doing things like knitting, crocheting, playing the piano, whatever, that if you can do something that's kind of physical, that your mind is kind of free to really wander and be where it is.
Yeah.
And you had some women that have just crocheted or knitted. I really don't know the difference. And they're just beautiful. They're hope, their joy, and they're really done very well. And you taught them to do that.
We do, because when I first created the class back in 2012, I included crafts like that, crocheting and embroidery. We even have some sewing machines, because I had read the research that when women sit quietly and use their hands, do something creative with their hands, they release more oxytocin, a really important brain chemical that can accelerate the healing process. So as soon as the women come into our class, we would hand them an embroidery hook and, you know, an embroidery loop and thread, and it's all donated, or a crochet hook, and they sit in a circle, and we open the circle up with everybody going around, even staff and volunteers, sharing a little bit, updating the women. We connect and support while they're using their hands. And I have seen, Mary, over the years, some of the most hardened women who have had to live on the streets or lose their children, some really hard stories, sex trafficking victims, sit down, and after a few classes, that whole process of creating with their hands and sharing in a safe, nurturing environment, it's just transformative. They feel safe. They feel nurtured. They feel seen. You know, they're not criminals to us. They're women. Women from our community who deserve a second chance and who deserve to be invited into the healing process. And that's what we create.
And again, we're talking to Barbara Rode, and she is the founder of the Red 10 Initiative. And, you know, I was particularly thinking about you and everything, and driving down to the station this morning, I saw, and it's a cold morning, damp and cold. And so I was pretty horrified when I looked and I saw on the median strip this woman, and she had this long coat on, but she was a crutch, but she only had one leg. And I was so horrified, because it is all so connected, our physical well-being, our mental well-being, and that, you know, that jails rarely have the kind of medical help that understands women's problems, et cetera. And I'm not trying to make this sound discouraging or despairing. That's not it at all. But the point is, everything is so connected, and as you said, women are particularly social. They particularly need those interconnections. That's really very important to them.
It is, and that's based on some research out of UCLA. A Dr. Shelley Taylor wrote a book a number of years ago called The Tending Instinct, how we women, when we're stressed or traumatized, benefit enormously from being able to come together in small groups with other women and share our stories, coach, mentor. It's just so important, as you're saying, Mary.
And tell me, Barbara, what can people do? How can we help?
Well, please go to our website, get involved. We're trying right now to raise enough money to create a virtual class. So if COVID continues to keep the door closed for us to physically go into the jail, we could present to them, if they're willing, a virtual class, so the women at least won't just be sitting in their cells for months and months and months and not benefiting from any resources or support or education. We need volunteers. We need more people also to be aware that this is, like you said, a community problem. It isn't us and them. One of my favorite parts of inviting people to come into the class when it's going is their eyes open up and they're shocked. I think a lot of people feel like, well, if you've done something bad and you go to jail, you're different than I am. They're no different. we're all the same. And if you come into our class, you would see somebody who reminds you of your sister or your cousin or your neighbor or yourself. And the women in the class are always grateful for anybody in the community who cares enough to get involved.
And 80% of them are mothers. And so what about their children? Because this must be a real worry to them. What about their children? What's happening to them?
It's enormous. Some of their children go into the foster care system. Some of them go with family members. It's enormous. And as much, we believe that by helping the mom, we are helping the children. I've gotten calls from partners, spouses, even children, telling me, I cannot believe the change in my mom. I was at a meeting before COVID last year hit, and I got to stand up and talk about Red Tent for a bit. And at the end, when I was packing my stuff up to leave, somebody tapped me on the shoulder, and I turned, and this 15-year-old girl was standing there. And she said, Miss Barbara, I think you might know my mom. And I said, really? What's your mom's name? And she said her name, and it rang a bell. Even though we've served almost 1,000 women, something about this woman stood out. She had been in our program about 5 years ago. She said, all my young life, my mom was an addict in and out of jail. And then she went to jail and went in Red Tent. And my mom has been clean and sober since then. And she starts crying. I started crying. And we hugged. And she said, I got my mom back thanks to Red Tent. So oftentimes, Mary, people will say to us, why aren't you focused on the children? We are. We're focused on their mother. And when you change the dynamics in that house and you help the mom realize she can make other choices, and she heals and chooses differently, you've helped that child.
Well, Barbara Rhodes, the Red Tent Initiative, we've covered quite a bit of subjects. Anything we haven't mentioned that you particularly wanted to mention? And again, their website, how can they find out more about you?
Please go to our website, redtentwomensinitiative.org. Please. Or call me. Can I give my number?
Sure.
727-418-7882. 418-7882. Or go to our website. We're always looking for people to get involved. And we want to spread to other jails and prisons throughout the world, Mary. That's our goal. It's a very grassroots program, and it could be duplicated anywhere.
Okay, well, Barbara Woods, thank you so much for all you do, all you've been doing, all you will continue to do, and also giving us this time this morning. You please do take care, okay?
Thank you very much. Thank you. Happy New Year.
Same to you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And again, you are listening to WMNF Tampa, Sarasota Clearwater Community Conscious Radio. Pretty impressive, wouldn't you say, Arlene?
Yes, indeed. And I have posted their website and a little bit of information on our Facebook page.
Okay, well, I'm going to put this music back on by Ani DeFranco, and then we will come back with Pam Campos.
Are you on now? Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
Well, I'm going to pod this music down because I am so excited to bring back to the show, because we had her on, it seems ages ago, but with everything that's happening, time has kind of become a different perspective. But Pam Campos Palma, and she's an Air Force veteran, and she leads the Vets for the People Project at the Working Families Party. And so, Pam Campos Palma, I really wanted to bring you back to the show, but as I just said to our last guest, you know, we all live in a nuclear context of our own family and our community. And particularly with your background, and because your background with the Air Force and all of your involvement with so many Liaison projects in both Kyrgyzstan, Iraq, Afghanistan, areas like that, how are you seeing right now what's happening in our country and the events we have experienced this week that happened in the Capitol, and then projecting forward to the inauguration? Just with your experience, how are you perceiving what's happening?
Sure. Thanks for having me on. I mean, first, I'm heartbroken. I think many other veterans, military members that I know, were just heartbroken to see white nationalist violence carried out in our name. I mean, the military trained me in counterterrorism. I was an intelligence analyst, and what is really concerning is that the attack that happened in the Capitol not only was done in our image, but seems to have been increasingly a planned attack. And so I feel heartbroken, but I'm also not surprised. I think that there has been a growing drumbeat that has ignored white nationalism as a threat, white supremacy as a threat, not just culturally in the United States, but even within our military and police.
Yeah, and, you know, I'm thinking of, actually, I'm thinking of you, I remember you arguing with Hillary Clinton when she was running. And you really, you're quite aware of the, you know, the kind of blowback from these various countries, the refugee problems, and that it would be folly not to think that that kind of underlying milieu is not going to affect the people in the services. I mean, that seems to me just to be human nature.
Absolutely. I mean, at the end of the day, I think that this country, the United States, has been in an endless cycle of warring, of more guns, more arming ourselves to the teeth in a way that actually doesn't understand the roots of instability, the roots of violence, really. And so I remember that moment very clearly. I'm glad you reminded me of it, where even then I was just so concerned. You know, I asked her, what will be done to really divest from militarism and invest in real security, economic, racial security, and justice, right? And so that's really on my heart this week, as we continue as a country to think that more guns and more armament of a fake security will keep us safe. And we watched last week that that is not the case.
Well, but also, I really want to get into the nitty-gritty of the military, particularly women in the military. You know, and I've been working with a group called Protect Our Defenders for years and have been very aware, actually, you know, of the problems they had literally when they were in the field, so to speak, that they felt they had a target both in the front and the back. And what, you know, that I think with the recent episode, not just episode, but with Vanessa Guillen and her family's, you know, protest and constantly protest. And then when they apparently Robinson, the individual that they think actually is the one who did murder her, then committed suicide. When they finally found her body, they found skeletal remains. And so, Pam, what is happening? And I don't mean just at Fort Hood, but we'll focus on that because that's where it was. What the heck is happening to women?
Mm-hmm. I mean, fundamentally, I believe that the Department of Defense as a whole, and even our national security strategies, have not grappled with the tension that in an ever-evolving time where we know that more diverse teams are important, the Department of Defense is one of the most traditional and hierarchical institutions. And we, women, people of color, queer and trans people, are continually treated as an interruption, an intrusion, and even a liability. And so when there are acts of violence that happen in the ranks, it is not only a problem, but it is normalized. And so a key question we must all continue to ask is, who is holding the top brass accountable? I mean, Tampa is a military town. There are significant military bases there. And one of the things that I think is a danger is that Congress, who is most able to hold them accountable, has really fallen into this blind adulation. All the generals are right. Don't question them. And in fact, that has helped and unfortunately made America also just say, thank you for your service. Don't ask any questions. It is our duty to ask the hard questions and to hold top brass accountable for not taking care of all of our troops, not just some, making sure that there is safety and making sure that corruption inside military forces is handled with expediently and soundly.
And, you know, this might not be at all related, but you know that when I mention to people what we're talking about, and particularly some of the men, as Trump, you know, said, you know, well, what do they expect? You know, you join the military to be harassed, mm-hmm. et cetera, but to be assaulted, to be killed. And, you know, that I remember reading, now this is quite a while ago, that actually in World War II, something like 1 out of 7 of our troops, actually, even though they carried guns and were right there on the front lines, never fired their gun. And were so glad they didn't have to. And also the same thing in Vietnam, particularly many Native Americans, et cetera, were very conflicted. You know, they understood. And just that hesitation, because when you've got these kind of weapons, nanoseconds we're talking. And so I don't mean to oversimplify this, but I think the military changed the way they train people. And I think that they're trained to be killers. And I think that's why we have so much post-traumatic stress syndrome of everybody. And so I might be totally off the wall, but the very simplest thing I can say, because they're trained to kill.
I think that has been something that folks have raised. A thing that I would raise is, we are also trained to be killed. And I think that we are treated increasingly as we are now. I mean, 2021 will be the 20th anniversary of 9/11. We are now in an endless, continual spiral of a global war on terror that was based on lies, an expanding national security apparatus that has only managed to survey and create more militarism against Black and brown communities. And the bottom line is, military members are increasingly treated as government property and not people. There is a lot of propagandizing around military families and we take care of each other. But if that were true, then we would not be in these wars that make no sense, that politicians can't answer for. We would not look callously or just turn a blind eye to training events where military members are dying. Training for what? Defending who? And so at the end of the day, I believe that, you know, the continual never-ending wars that many Americans just are disconnected to. Many Americans don't know that we, you know, are occupying several different wars, not just one, not just Iraq and Afghanistan. And so this is what I believe propels and is important to remember, that I believe that not only is moral injury a cause of high suicide rates, but it is also the abuse and corruptive culture inside the military that does not actually see soldiers' humanity.
Yeah, at the bottom line, we're all people, you know, and I really feel that people's hearts, I think, really are loving and generous and want for others what they have for themselves. I don't mean to sound Pollyannish with that, but I honestly believe that. And everybody is being abused. And peace is so much harder than war. as you are so aware, you know, I mean, and then I'm coming back to the women again, that not only, you know, is peace more important, but also, you know, the services they have, you know, the veterans hospitals, they don't have the designated wards or the doctors who know how to treat women. And this is absolutely essential. And also more and more women in the military, and aren't they one, the largest single growing segment? Women, and particularly women of color, are going into the military?
Absolutely, especially at the enlisted ranks. And I mean, we must all think very hard that too many conflicts, I believe that conflict will always exist. The question is, how do we handle conflict together? And too often, even when COVID hit, it was send in the military. A problem, send in the military. Another problem, send in the military. The military is not some tool that can just be, you know, toiled at every single issue, particularly in this moment. I worry that the response will be just more militarism, more abuse of military forces without really thinking about what do we need the military for, right? And so I think that as, and the other thing I'll say is the military has become, unfortunately, in the absence of Medicare for All, in the absence of, you know, education that's accessible to folks, you know, people like myself, particularly people of color and women and poor people, are looking to join the military in this time of austerity. And so it's a cycle that breaks my heart where we as a country cannot just come together, get what we need, the human rights, the basic policies for our humanity to live, and then also not churn and burn our people in a military and war machine that has not made us safe. And in fact, further abused our people. And so, you know, one important thing for me in my work is military members and veterans are often exploited by politicians of both parties to keep championing a war economy that doesn't make us safe. And so I am assertively organizing military veterans and military members. We have a call tonight at 8 p.m. On the Vets for the People Facebook page, where we are coming together to organize in our own voice, in our own dreams of how we want to live and the politics we need for us.
Yeah, didn't you organize when the Women's March occurred right after Trump was inaugurated, the Vets for Peace or whatever the name you gave, but didn't you organize that too?
Yeah, I mean, in 2015, I thought I was going to go to the State Department. I really wanted to, my life goal was to end these wars. And I thought I was going to go to the State Department and do that. I saw Trump's campaign on war crimes, and I dropped everything to organize military veterans because I was worried. And for years, I have been worried about what happened last week. It has been a drumbeat for 4 years of a fascistic commander-in-chief who has really attacked groups of people, civil rights. And so the last 4 years, I have aggressively organized and tried to really develop leaders, civic leaders, just like Medgar Evers. Medgar Evers was a World War II veteran and a civil rights leader who was assassinated by another veteran who was in the Ku Klux Klan. And so we play an important role. We need to stand on the right side of history.
You know, again, we're talking to Pam Campos Palma, and actually she is with the People's Project, the Vets for People Project at the Working Families Party. And Pam, I hope, you know, I think you're too important to have a political career, but I hope you are writing some books extensively, because I think you have so much information, and I think you have it from the perspective of a veteran, but also seeing in the larger context. And my word, do we desperately need it right now, because I really consider you a treasure trove. And I'm thinking, actually, and I you know, I've lost track of who's now in charge of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. I'm not even sure he has one. But Milley, that he was actually technically at Fort Hood when Fort Hood was at some of its worst levels of both murders and suicides. And so what does that say?
Again, I think that... I think that it is one thing that is there. It's easy to say we just need to shoot all the threats with guns. It's harder to say that white supremacy is a real issue. White, you know, mediocre and even failed white men failing up in national security is a national security threat. And that's not sexy. That's not, you know, the war lethality, national security talk that people want to talk about. But it's really important that I mean, consistently there has been an inequity where, you know, powerful, affluent white men from military families have ascended to the highest ranks of the military, which in essence is basically being a politician yourself and a CEO. It's like a hybrid corporate CEO politician. But you're really hidden from the American public. And so, you know, a lot of these top generals are groomed, you know, to then be the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the secretary of the Army. And it's really important that this is, for me, why it's important for us to organize politically, to build political education, and to build public awareness around these failures, frankly. No one should be rewarded when there was a human trafficking ring at Fort Hood. That should have completely disqualified Mark Milley from being chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. The fact that it wasn't tells me that we are complacent and that this is a system that is much more rotted, and it will take the will of the people to demand that it change.
And Arlene, you had something to say?
I just had a question to add. I'm the co-host of the show, and it seems to me one of the things that I'm concerned about is the fact that we really have never dealt with the issue of racism in this country. And it's been here from our founding days, and it's still here. And until we deal with it, I don't think that we can solve some of these problems. What do you think, Pamela?
I think that's 1,000,000% right. I believe, as a former counterterrorist intelligence analyst and as a queer Latina who grew up, I saw racism by the time I was 5. We can have no healing without accountability. And accountability starts with ourselves. And so I think a lot of people are really hinged on the caricature of a white nationalist storming the Capitol. And yes, that is an incredible threat. You know, white nationalist violence has rationalized genocide and eugenics and enslavement and even the global war on terror, which is Islamophobic, if you think about it, right? And has actually panned out Islamophobia in American society. But we also have to just really interrupt the white supremacy in our own communities, the casual racism in the police and in the military, in our workplaces. And I think that is one of the major reasons that many people don't want to see this as one of the highest civic callings of our time. And it is. Because it means that we might lose our cousins. We might lose familial relationships. Some people have even gotten fired for standing up for injustice. But that is our highest calling. And it's going to take all of us to shift the culture and to really demand healing and progress.
And again, we're talking to Pam Campos, Palma, and I'm going to go back to Fort Hood, if I could, because they had meetings, et cetera, and that the problem has so often been that they said, well, these soldiers just went AWOL. They just disappeared. And we're talking both men and women. And then when they actually then had a big meeting and they had the women all there, the women were asked how many of them, you know, had been assaulted or had been harassed, etc., and did they feel, you know, that they were taking it seriously, that, you know, that it, 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 it Vanessa's family got so much attention that Jackie Speier and Gillibrand and others in Congress were ready, and they did a study and, you know, of that community, et cetera. And what they found was very, very troubling. And one of the biggest problems was, yes, they just said they went AWOL. And luckily their families would say, they were having all kinds of problems, and they had reported it. And then they were told, you know, well, they'd be separated, et cetera. But then they became afraid to report it. And going back to Vanessa, that she was hammered to death, and if Robertson's girlfriend hadn't actually said what happened and they actually found the body, that it is no wonder that a woman would not feel safe at all, wouldn't know what to do. And what happens at Fort Hood, and as you say here, I have no idea what's happening here in Tampa. I can only hope that that kind of stuff isn't happening. But, you know, what do you say, Pam?
I say a few things. I say with a heavy heart that if it's happening at Fort Hood, it is happening across the Army, and it is happening probably in other branches. And when I say it is happening, I am not implying that murders like Vanessa Gann's horrific murder are happening. But, and I think we need to kind of zoom out. I think that what was really hard for me organizing for Justice for Vanessa Gann was there was so much attention on the gruesome details of her death, and there was not as much attention as to what led to a culture that allowed her be killed in that way, right? She told her mother that she was being sexually harassed by a superior officer. It is also my assessment that I don't necessarily believe that that is how she was killed. A lot of things do not add up, and at the end of the day, the military cannot police itself, and that's exactly what it has done at Fort Hood. The military gets to say, well, it's just these lower enlisted troops that don't know any better. They're the problem. Well, it was another junior enlisted person that killed her. And this has been, enlisted people have been the scapegoat for bigger structural problems and corruption at higher levels for decades. And so what I say is, I have received calls from Fort Hood families who have told me that their families are sick because their military housing is not up to, is this, in squalor, that they're living in squalor, they're not given PPE, even in COVID. And again, this goes back to, do we care enough about our soldiers to actually ask the hard questions of accountability at every military base? Are we building connections? One of the things that came out of the Fort Hood report was that Fort Hood didn't even have protocols for AWOL. So don't talk to me about people just going missing if you don't want to address why they're going missing and why, on the most secure government installations in the world, you can't keep our people safe. The other thing I'll say that I think has not been discussed as much is the Department of Defense is really in a moment where America is fatigued of war. Military members are tired of wars that no politician can answer for. And so the Department of Defense and many of the generals are really looking for ways to innovate and basically package a different strategy to keep, you know, paying for these wars and paying for machinery. And I think that that is somewhere where we need to look. People should be asking, how are military bases in my community treating the soldiers? What are their priorities? At Fort Hood, this general that is also doing another investigation on the base is also the head of Army Futures Command, the command that is entrusted with modernizing the Army. So there's a conflict of interest there. You cannot actually hold your workplace accountable if you're also in charge of, you know, the making your workplace look better. And so I think that we need to take a labor justice lens to these things. A feminist lens to these things and a racial justice lens if we want to really stop the harm.
Wow. Pam Campos, you can cover a huge range, but is there anything we didn't mention that you particularly wanted to mention before I let you go?
Just that I call on every person. Again, I think it was mentioned, it's on all of us to do this work. And I really do believe that we can do it. There's a role for military veterans and members. You know, military members are prohibited from, you know, participating in partisan activities, but white nationalist violence is not partisan. You know, needing to expel these corrupt politicians who are conspiring with white nationalist paramilitaries in this moment is important. I'm very concerned about soldiers being confused about this. And so it's on all of us to really push to expel, particularly these members of Congress that love to wrap themselves in support of the troops and waving the flag. And I call on even civilians to look and think about the military connections in your life. Do you have a brother or an uncle who served? You know, do you have a friend? Touch base with them. Ask them what their experience are so that we don't continue to operate in silos. And lastly, go to the Vets for the People Facebook page tonight at 8 p.m. We will be doing a mass call with other Black and brown women veterans who are leading the movement for human rights and civil liberties to talk about how veterans can act in this moment.
Pam Campos-Palma, thank you so much for all you're doing, you keep doing, and will do. Please write a lot. Thanks again. Take care.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Arlene?
Yes, we've had a number of comments, and I thank you all for your emails and calls. But I thought this one was particularly related to what we've been talking about. This came from Jack in Palm Harbor. He said, I am going into my 93rd year and am a World War II vet. I have lived through the war, the McCarthy era, and and have never felt more threatened than I feel now. What we have is a large segment of our population believing the lies and disinformation that might bring our country down. Thank you for your comment, and it's something for all of us to think about.
We're up to it. We can do it, people. And we're the ones we've been waiting for, whether we know it or not. You're always more than you think you are. So let's go out homoerotic. Things that I'm thinking.
Could put me in prison. The things that I'm thinking could put me in prison. The things that I'm thinking could put me in prison. The things that I'm thinking could put me in prison. The things that I'm thinking could put me in prison. The things that I'm thinking could put me in prison. The things that I'm thinking could put me in prison. The things that I'm thinking could put me in prison. Someone owns the sky, someone owns the trees, someone owns